We have a new topic that we're beginning in lecture, which is a new functional group, amines. Now, I don't quite know, because I haven't read if there is, a logic behind how amines were organized for this text, but it appears that the author didn't care for amines very much. And I have to admit that there's so much of our organic chemistry that's all about oxygen. We were dealing with alcohols, and then we were dealing with carbonyls, which still had oxygen. And then we dealt with carboxylic acids that still had oxygen in it. But this is the first time we're focusing mainly on nitrogen, which does have a very different reactivity, partly because given equivalent carbon structures, an oxygen is not basic while a nitrogen is. So that's one huge difference right there. And then oxygen is divalent, meaning it only has two bonds normally, whereas amines or nitrogen is usually trivalent, again changing the type of reactivity that we have and even how we refer to compounds. In fact, the first thing we're going to review is what do the terms primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary mean for amines versus alcohols or other functional groups. So we're going to review that. We'll do a little bit of discussion of nomenclature, a fair amount of discussion about acid-base properties, because again, amines are bases. Then, we probably won't get into this today, we'll probably run out of time, but we need to get into the different ways to synthesize amines. And there are at least 8 different sections in your book where these reactions are found. There is no one chapter on amines. And I do understand that in some senses, but it doesn't make it very convenient if we're trying to address it as a functional group. So I'll give you some guidance where to find these different reactions once we get to that point, but let's start out with just talking about types of amines and then nomenclature. So let me draw a series of very simple amines. The primary structural feature of an amine is the fact that it has a carbon-nitrogen single bond. And we do have these terms primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, which differ for these amines. How is the term, for example, secondary, used differently for an amine than it would for an alcohol? And it's attached directly to the nitrogen itself. So remember, for a lot of the other functional groups we had in the past, if we called it secondary, what that meant is the functional group was on a carbon that itself was secondary, meaning it had two alkyl groups attached. Because the reactivity of amines focuses largely on the nitrogen and not what kind of carbon you have, then that's why the terms refer to how many alkyl groups are on the nitrogen itself. So from left to right, these are examples of a primary, secondary, tertiary, and then quaternary, but technically this is quaternary ammonium salt because it is charged. But it is possible, in fact, sometimes it's easy to make these tetrasubstituted amines, as we will see a little bit of today. So let me just write the statement down that the designation of primary, secondary, whatever, for amines depends on the number of alkyl groups on the nitrogen itself, and not on the type of carbon that is next to that nitrogen. So this you've seen before. So let's move on to nomenclature. For non-cyclic amines, there's generally two forms of nomenclature used. One is common nomenclature, which you'll see quite a bit, and then there's a more systematic, the substitutive nomenclature, IUPAC nomenclature. So for common nomenclature, you just list the alkyl groups attached to the nitrogen itself. So in this example compound, we have two ethyl groups. So this is just called diethyl amine. Very similar to the way that common names for ethers are generated. We have diethyl ether, our common lab solvent, where you just name the fact that there's two alkyl groups. But recall that the systematic name for ether treats an ether as an alkoxide. Well, and it's not exactly the same thing that's done here, but we do identify one main parent chain, because that's how substitutive nomenclature always works. You try to find the longest carbon chain that contains the most important functional group. So we'll take that same compound, and since it's symmetric, in other words, you have two ethyl groups attached, it doesn't matter which one we select as the main chain, but one of them we'll just declare as such. And again, that parent chain, and again, this is a review concept, but I know we haven't done much extensive nomenclature for a while. This parent chain is the longest carbon chain with the most important functional group. Once we've got that parent chain, then we treat the other alkyl group as a substituent to nitrogen.
Means longest. That's what I said. It's symmetric, so it doesn't matter which one you choose.
So having chosen one, we take one of the alkyl groups, we make it a substituent, and for the carbon chain, you would still number it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as you normally would. Since we have a substituent on the nitrogen, we use this N designation. So this is N-ethyl. Ethanamine. Notice that the systematic name, the last part of that compound is not an ill ending. Ethaneamine, not ethylamine. If you say ethylamine, that's the common name. Now, this is a little bit of an aside, but you've seen this N before, if only briefly. And where it showed up is with one of the solvents that we used in SN2 reactions. So I know that we may not have ever done the nomenclature of amides, but just like we add amine to the end of a name, we would just add amide to the end of a name. So if we had the two carbon amide, it would be ethaneamide. This is a one carbon amide, so its systematic name would be methanamide. Does anybody happen to remember or know what the common name is for the one carbon carboxylic acid? Oh, no, DMSO, that's something totally different. Formic, right? So formic acid turns into formamide for the amide. But this amide has two alkyl groups on it as well, doesn't it? Since they're both on the same nitrogen, even though they're on the same nitrogen, we can't just say N-dimethyl. You have to say where each substituent is, just like we would even if there were no nitrogens there. Any compound, we put two methyl groups on it, we say where the position of each one is. So this compound is N-N-dimethylformamide. Or DMF for short. If you don't recall, this is often used in SN2 reactions because it's polar, but it's aprotic. It's also just for a chance for me to show you another place where you have seen this N designation. Now, we're not going to tackle it today, and we may not ever, unless there's a really good specific case molecule we would need to do it for. Question came up, what happens if you have two nitrogens, a diamine? And what if you have substituents on both of them? Well, the common way is to use what's called prime notation. So we write N to mean substitution on one nitrogen. Then N prime, same prime you'd use in derivatives, to show that it's the other nitrogen. But since we're unlikely to have any of those examples, I'm not going to make us learn, because then there's a whole other set of rules that I don't want us to get too deeply involved in. You do need to know a little bit about cyclic amine nomenclature, because that gets tricky. And so let me show you the very limited number of examples that we're going to tackle. Because there's two types of cyclic amines. There's one type where the nitrogen is not in the ring. Meaning that the compound is cyclic, but it has an amino group dangling off of it. Well, then this is named like any other amine, because you just have an R group attached. You name that R group and then name the amine. So this is cyclohexane amine. That's not too bad. Where things get bad is the next case, where the nitrogen is in the ring. Because that becomes what is known as a heterocycle. Which is a cyclic molecule in which one or more atoms of the ring have been replaced by something other than carbon. Now, why are these heterocycles important? Well, there's certain heterocycles that we can make polymers out of. There's other heterocycles that you find, for example, as the basis of the base pairs in DNA. And so often if we go through the heterocyclic chapter, it's just to pick up some of those nitrogenous cyclic compounds, again, that show up in DNA. As far as nomenclature, here's the complication. There's what's known as replacement nomenclature. So we're going to have a prefix that we can use to mean take out a carbon, put something else in. There's also common nomenclature. So many of the cyclic amines have their own common names. And I saw a chart once of the common 100s, and it gets... It's amazing because you get things like pyridine, piperidine, pyrrolidine, pyrrolidine, or whatever very close sounding combinations. We're going to see that in a moment just with a couple of examples I am going to have you learn. Some compounds you gotta know. Pyrrole is called pyrrole. That's just its accepted common name. But there's also this naming system that I can't even remember the name of the naming system because it's some set of German names or something that I just never memorized. But this complicated system has endings that the ending doesn't just mean a functional group. So it's not as simple as just own, ain, een, all. The name means both the functional group and how many atoms are in the ring and how many of them are heteroatoms. So you might remember the name oxaphosphatane. Does that sound familiar at all? Do we remember the Wittig reaction? Do you remember intermediate where you had a four-membered ring and you had a carbon, an oxygen, a carbon, and a phosphorus? Phosphorus and oxygen. Oxaphosphatane. The phetane means four-membered ring. Oxa means oxygen, for phosphorus. So oxaphosphatane literally means four-membered ring with oxygen and phosphorus in it. So you'll see on chapter 21, I think it is. Darn, I just looked earlier. Hold on. Oh, I said them out loud yesterday, but I didn't write them down, it looks like. Well, there's a chapter on heterocycles, and it gives you some of those examples. We're not going to bother with that nomenclature system because it would take a whole bunch of effort to memorize all those different endings that we'll never use outside of this chapter. So our default is going to be replacement nomenclature. So let me show you that. Since we're going to be talking just about amines today, I'll just show you the aza with an A prefix. That means replace carbon with nitrogen. So, for example, if I had this 4-carbon nitrogen, this is aza cyclobutane. There is, again, common nomenclature. So just to give you two common names, six-membered saturated cyclic amine is called piperidine. Five-membered saturated ring. Remember, pyrrole is an unsaturated compound. So five-membered saturated is pyrrolidine. The idine ending does have something to do with saturation. It's a little more complicated than that, but again, it's another set of nomenclature rules I don't want us to get lost in. Then there's this third system that is mentioned in the heterocycle chapter, but we're not going to use at all. So questions on primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary are on these examples of amine nomenclature. Now, the amine nomenclature is all the way back at the beginning of the book, page 45, for example, and 57, I think, somewhere right around there, first or second chapter, where it gives you the introduction to nomenclature. If there's not any questions, let's move on to the real big topic for today, which is acid-base properties of amines. Now, if you took my advice that I gave at the beginning of the quarter, and you've been reviewing some acid-base chemistry here and there, this part of the lecture won't be difficult. If you have none, no review for acid-based chemistry, you might follow this, or you might get, not confused, because I think you will follow it, but you might get scared a little bit. Because here's the thing, if you look in most texts, when they start giving you compounds like piperidine, you can look this up and find out that its pKa of the conjugate is equal to 11.27. So based on the discussion I had with someone after class yesterday, I want to ask this question. Does this mean that piperidine is basic or acidic to start with? And does it mean whether it's a strong acid or base? So let's take the first question first. Is piperidine an acid or a base? But I quoted you a pKa value, didn't I? So is this the pKa value for piperidine? Well, no, because I have written right there, it's the pKa of the conjugate. But what does that mean? That means for most amines, when you go to a table and you're looking up pKa values, you're getting them in the protonated form, which that is the conjugate form. And so the pKa value describes this dissociation, remaking the neutral amine. The pKa of an average amine is something like 35 to 40. And you might recall that someone did look up and find that LDA had a pKa of, not LDA, sorry, the amine from which LDA is made has a pKa of 35. That nitrogen doesn't want to be negative. It is less electronegative than oxygen. So there's no good driving force for a hydrogen to come off. To say it one more time then, this pKa value of 11.27 I gave you is for the conjugate, which means that the amine itself is basic. Now, is this conjugate a strong or a weak acid? Weak acid, okay? So does that mean the amine itself is a strong or a weak base? No. And this is bad programming that almost all of us do in Chem 1A. It's not bad programming, it's just there's a subtlety there. You learned in Chem 1A that when you have a weak acid, it has a strong conjugate. Not always true. Because what if you had something that had pKa of 7? In water, what would the pKb be of its conjugate? Also 7, right? 7's right in the middle of strength, but both the acid and the base have that same pKa or pKb value. So the acid is weak and the base is weak. Now, if the acid got weaker, the conjugate base would be stronger. So you're allowed to say weaker base, stronger base. But if I say something's a weak base, that doesn't mean its conjugate's a strong acid. This is a pKa of 11.27. In water, its pKa of the conjugate would be 3.73, which is not that much higher than acetic acid, which we classify as a weak acid. So both the conjugate and the base are weak. So as we have this discussion, what we're going to be talking about is weaker and stronger, because those terms we can always use. All right. So having said that, let me make this observation. Because some of you that are good with numbers might benefit from this, because at some point in the distant past, I realized that the pKa of ammonium, is 9.25, which means that the pKb of ammonia is 4.75. 4.75 happens to be exactly the value of the pKa of acetic acid. So in other words, the acid strength of a carboxylic acid is roughly equivalent to the base strength of an average amine.
So in general, amines are weak bases. With base strengths, again measured by pKb, that are comparable to the average acid strength, which means we're back to talking about pKa, of a carboxylic acid. Generally, roughly in the range of 4 to 6. That means the average pKa of the conjugate is somewhere between 9 and 11.
Now, what I've shown you is an alkyl amine. I want to show you an aromatic amine next. In fact, I want to show you two of them because we need to talk about how it being part of an aromatic system is affecting its acidity or basicity. So here's a compound from last quarter. What's the name of it? Aniline.
And it has a conjugate pKa of 4.58.
So which is the stronger base? Piperidine up top or aniline down below? And let me scoot this down so you can see that the pKa of the piperidinium ion is 11.27 and the anilinium ion is 4.58. So which is the better base? Which is the stronger base? Piperidine or aniline? Now for those of you who are looking at it like, boy, that's a good question. What is the answer, Dr. Gray? This is why you need to review your acid-base chemistry. Because let me write down the question. And you have exactly the same combination of surprise, concern, and confusion that the other two sections did at this point. The question was, which is a stronger base? Piperidine or aniline? The follow-up question that I asked yesterday, and I will ask you, is which is the stronger acid conjugate? The aniline, right? Because the lower the pKa, the stronger an acid is. So
let me write that down. Well, we'll come back to that in a second, but let's do this first. Which is the stronger acid conjugate? Well, as I just said, we have the piperidinium ion, which I'm writing these names out to get you used to the idea that to make an ion out of it, you just add the IUM ending. So piperidinium. That piperidinium ion had a pKa of 11.27, whereas the anilinium had a pKa of 4.58. Which, yes, means it is the stronger acid. We're still not going to say strong,
Because it's got a pKa under 4. Or above 4, sorry. But it's stronger than pyridinium.
And just as an aside here, remember that lower pKa is the same thing as saying stronger acid.
So because the anilinium is the stronger acid, the conjugate, anilin itself, is the weaker base. So yes, piperidine is the stronger base. And we can use equations to demonstrate it, or I often try to do the concept approach, which is this. If you have something that really likes letting go of the proton, that means it doesn't want the proton back. If you have a strong acid, it means it gives away the proton. Its conjugate, the base, doesn't want to get that proton back. Other way around. If you have a weak acid that's holding on to that proton, then that means if you had the base, it's going to try to get that proton because it wants it. So here we're saying that anilin doesn't want the proton. The question is, why? Yes. Because nitrogen has the ability to delocalize very easily. We already saw that in our reduction of amide mechanism. We saw that how else did we see that? Why? We were talking about amides, the lone pair of amides being heavily involved with that carbonyl. And we actually need to come back to that in this chapter, because we're going to talk about some reactions of amides at the same time we talk about amines. So the lone pair in that nitrogen is heavily involved with the benzene ring, which means if you protonate the nitrogen, you'll lose that ability to delocalize. Well, that delocalization ends up being favorable, so to break it is unfavorable, so it doesn't want the proton, so it's not as basic.
So the why in this case is the lone pair on nitrogen is heavily conjugated with the neighboring aromatic ring. So, and to say it simply, that means it's less able to act as a base.
Now let me throw up a comparison example.
Because this first one, anilin, was an aromatic amine in which the nitrogen was still not actually in the ring. Here is a heterocycle, pyrrole. And it has a conjugate pKa of the pyrrolium ion of negative 3.8. What does that mean? It means if you put a proton in pyrrole, it wants right back off again. Negative 3.8 is strongly, strongly acidic. In excess of 99% dissociation. All right? And let me just say this. Since the pyrrolinium ion is so strong,
That means Pearl itself. Is a weak, and actually we can use the term, weak base. Since we did identify the acid as being that strong, automatically its conjugate now is weak. Why? Why does pyrrole not want a hydrogen? Because that's what this means. Is pyrrole aromatic? Why? Because the H what? The H is orthogonal to what? Which means what's happening to the lone pair? No, not hyperconjugation, full conjugation. This is aromatic, which means that lone pair is formally delocalized. Well, it wouldn't be, though, if you protonate it. Because if you protonate it, you end up with an sp3 hybridized center that blocks aromaticity. Aromaticity, we know, is a big stabilization force. We spent a lot of time last quarter talking about how this unusual stability results because of aromaticity. So pyrrole is not a base because gaining a proton would break aromaticity, which is highly unfavorable. Now, currently, I had not planned to heavily go through the heterocycle chapter. We're supposed to address amines. In principle, we're supposed to acknowledge there are these heterocycles. But that's only if we have enough time after carbohydrates and amino acids, because I want to make sure that we have the time to properly do the bio sections this time around. The one thing from that chapter I'd like to show you, since I'm already talking about pyrrole, is something I guess I should have known from the past, but hadn't made that realization. That if you protonate pyrrole, it doesn't go to the nitrogen. You know, we see that lone pair of nitrogen and think, oh, it's going to protonate there. Why? If it's aromatic, the lone pair is everywhere. Where would it make more sense for the lone pair to be when protonation occurs? Well, we can get an idea of that by just looking at some resonance structures of pyrrole. And this kind of idea came up when we did the stork enamine synthesis, that even before we let the compound react, we could still push the lone pair around and see what kind of structure we would end up with. Well, we'd end up with a positive charge on nitrogen, which we'd expect, but we also end up with a negative charge at the position right next to the hydrogen. Well, which is more
that's not a question I want to get into.
This resonance structure is favorable enough that it shows, though, that there's electron density not on the nitrogen. And in fact, this is how it gets protonated. That in real life, whatever that is, when protonation occurs, it happens on that side addition. This is related to other forms of electrophilic aromatic substitution, which this effectively is. But this, because of that nitrogen having an effect of where electron density ends up, this is a directed electrophilic aromatic substitution. Let me go ahead and draw here what the product would look like. So we have one carbon that now have two hydrogens, which again means we have an sp3 hybridized center, which blocks aromaticity. So we saw three compounds, three types of amines: a linear amine, a cyclic amine, but one that was aromatic, and then a third amine that was also aromatic, but the nitrogen being part of the ring itself. I want to leave you with a question that I'm not going to answer at the moment, but looking through your text, I observed the following: that the six-membered ring cyclic amine, piperidine, has a conjugate pKa of 11.27, like I quoted earlier. If we look at its five-membered ring equivalent, pyrrolidine, it turns out that the conjugate pKa is only 11.12. All we've done is change the number of atoms in the ring, but it's changed its basicity. And again, I won't answer why yet, but I'm going to ask why. Maybe that will elicit some responses Thursday. Questions before I move on to the last bit of acid-base chemistry for the day. You're looking up the conjugates instead. I'm not sure how it show it. It might show the compound and have a big star at the top saying these values are for the conjugate. It might write the structures of the conjugate out. It might just name them. Different textbooks use different approaches. Okay, so last thing for today. It's the following set of compounds: ammonia, ethanamine, and then N-methyl ethanamine. Turns out those conjugates have strengths of 9.25, 10.81, and 11.02. Which, just to have done it once, let me write out the conjugates. Just so I can name this one to show you that eum ending. So this is ethanammonium with two M's, sorry. This is the ethanammonium ion. So which one of these conjugates, ammonium, ethane ammonium, or an ethyl ethanammonium, is the stronger acid? My question is the conjugates. Which one's the stronger acid? On the left or the right? Left, because again, lower pKa value means a higher strength in the acid. So these are the stronger acid conjugates. So now separate those out and look back at the bases themselves. From left to right, are we going up or down in base strength? Well, if we have the weaker acid on the right, that means its conjugate is the stronger base. So we go from left to right, now we have stronger bases. Why am I pointing this out? To show you why we do need to learn these different routes for synthesizing amino acids. They're not amino acids, amines. We'll get to amino acids. Because the first step in an SN2 reaction involving an amine, which if you go back to 12A, I probably never did an amine substitution, even though it was listed as one of the nucleophiles as far as relatively good nucleophiles. That's because of the following problem. After we do SN2, which will be followed up with a deprotonation, if I use exactly this example here of ethyl chloride and ammonia, the two of them will make ethanamine. But that means that I started with something that was a weaker base, and because of the alkyl group, and we'll talk about why this has this effect, that alkyl group has made this a stronger base. Which I'll know they're not the same thing. In this case, that also means it's a stronger nucleophile. So it reacts again to make the ethanamine, which from the numbers above is an even stronger base. So it reacts again and again until you end up with, well, its common name will be the tetraethylammonium ion. And I know we're out of time, so let me just wrap this up with one last statement summarizing what I've shown you, and we'll pick up with this on Thursday. That SN2 reactions involving amines are generally problematic. Since the product is usually more basic than reactant. So it can be difficult to prevent multiple alkylation. Now we're really out of time, so I'll start showing you examples of reactions next time. But let me just show you for right now in index A12, the appendix in the back of your text, it has a list of reactions of all different functional groups. But specifically, it also has the list of reactions to form amines. So you want to start looking at that to figure out which sections you'll need to review in your text. So we'll continue with amines next time.